way we behave and how we reach Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We have the very famous surah of the Quran, Surah Asr, which says, you know, God says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wal Asr, innal insana lafi khusr. He swears by Asr, by time, that every human being is at a loss. And one of the main losses is, of course, of time. Now, what are some practical things that we can do that can really help utilize our time? So one of the things I think we all know, for example, is scheduling our time, right? Scheduling our week. To give you an example of what I really mean, I like using this example many times. There's this famous personality on Instagram and on YouTube. He is a former American soldier. He's a commander. And you know what he does every morning? He wakes up at 4:30 and he posts a picture of his clock to show that he's woken up every morning at 4:30. And he does this every single day without any sort of, you know, breaks in his routine. He's trying to motivate people to discipline themselves and to discipline themselves to wake up every single morning. There's another very famous saying of some of these people. They say that discipline will bring you freedom, right? When you start disciplining yourself and your time, it will bring you a kind of freedom that you don't really always understand. Many times what happens is that we don't really schedule our days, and then we end up having, for example, let's say 2 to 3 hours where we don't know what to do. What do we do to fill up that time? We'll start looking at our phones, we'll start scrolling through social media, you know, we'll start watching movies and TV shows. And that's not necessarily the best use of our time. That is not necessarily going to help us to improve ourselves and to reach God. So imagine if you could schedule every single hour of your day. You would know exactly what you're doing 1 week from now, 2 weeks from now, a month from now, at every single hour. Wouldn't that make a huge difference in your life? You could set your goals that you want to achieve, and you can schedule them into your day and work on them. It's another way of reducing distractions from our life, and it allows us to truly become focused on what we want. And Islamic spirituality requires that very intense focus. It requires a very intense kind of motivation to remain consistent on this path. So there are a few steps within the step, right? There's the step of removing distractions. There's the step of remaining consistent in what we want to do. And there's a step of remaining motivated in what we want. There's a very interesting story that comes from a businessman. You know, he quotes the story. He says that you have all these kind of sort of motivational speakers that try to motivate people to be successful in their life. He says that he met one of these kind of motivational speakers and he said, you know, I really want to be successful. What should I do? What can I do? So he says, all right, you know, wake up tomorrow morning at 5 and meet me at the beach. And maybe some of you guys have heard this story before because it's quite popular, but I still find it to be a good story to repeat. So this man, he wakes up at 5 in the morning, he goes to the beach, you know, he's wearing like a suit and he's wearing a dress, and he meets this motivational speaker. The speaker tells him, you know, go and walk into the water. He goes and he says, you know, in these clothes, he says, yeah, just go walk into the water. He keeps walking, and the guy says, you know, keep walking, until the water reaches the person's neck. And then the person, the motivational speaker, takes his head and dips it into the sea, right? He's almost trying to drown him. And then he takes him out of the water. So this person is gasping for breath. You know, he's saying, you know, what's going on? You know, I was here to like learn how to be successful. This motivational speaker says, you know, when you were drowning, what did you want at that time? And he says, you know, of course, I wanted to breathe. I wanted air. And the speaker says that when you want success, like the way a drowning person wants air, that's when you will be successful. Right? So you really, really need to want it, to be extremely motivated to reach God. And when you're that motivated, you will have the motivation to discipline yourself, to schedule your life, and to make yourself better. We have to go for a quick break. And when I come back, we'll continue speaking about this.
Yeah.
topic that I've been speaking about, Islamic spirituality, and one of the steps towards that is utilizing our time wisely. What is the best way of using our time? As I mentioned, that we need to schedule every hour of our life. We need to know what we're doing. Now, scheduling our life isn't necessarily only related to Islamic spirituality, but it's actually a good habit for all aspects of our life. For example, if you're a student and you're studying, then you know you'll be told you need to spend, for example, a certain number of hours a day studying. This, you know, if you need to work on your health, then you can set a time, for example, exercise. And all of these actions are, in a way, worship themselves. If we do all of these things for the sake of God, if you're studying, if you're exercising, if you're spending time, you know, with our families, and even if it's time, for example, on entertainment, halal entertainment, of course, then these all become acts of worship. Studying and exercise and disciplining, these are all extremely important aspects of our lives, right? For example, if you're not exercising, then that can impact your physical health. If your physical health is impacted, then you'll have a more difficult time, for example, doing worship, doing ibadat and your prayers. It can impact your prayers. It can impact, for example, fasting. So having a really, really strong routine, which involves and balances all aspects of your life, is going to help you improve spiritually as well. It's not only about, for example, praying. It's not only about fasting. It's about having a well-balanced life, which where you're healthy spiritually, where you're healthy physically, and where you're healthy mentally. Let's say you look at some old politicians that are out there right now, right? You'll see that even, for example, the president of the United States, Joe Biden, if you see some of his videos, he forgets what he's saying. He forgets where he is on stage, right? He's suffering, for example, from Alzheimer's. You'll see that these people start losing their mental faculties. And not only that, you'll see that even on a physical level, they start their face and their physical, for example, demeanor starts to deteriorate. Whereas if you look at, for example, many of our scholars, you'll see that as they get older, there's a lot more grace in them. Their face becomes even more full of light. You can see that their mental faculties become even sometimes sharper. And you see that when they speak so softly and they speak so well. You don't see them forgetting, for example, things, right? You see that their memories are still very strong. Where is this power coming from, right? It's from a life of discipline. It's from a life of spending time on focusing on God and doing worship in the best manner possible. The advice that you will always get from these people, one of the first steps, you know, towards improving yourself is to schedule your time, is to discipline yourself and have a strong routine in your life. We have a hadith, a narration from the Prophet. He says that, you know, 1 hour of thinking, of pondering can be better than, for example, 70 years of worship. So again, the emphasis is on using our time here, is using that, for example, that 1 hour to really ponder and think. This is what the Quran also tells us, you know, use your time to ponder and think about things, to correct. And it's not just about thinking about random things. It's really to think and ponder upon the signs of God. This is how we can become much closer to God and how we can correct our way of thinking and how we can also reach God and become closer to Him. So thank you so much for listening. Inshallah, please join us again on an episode of A Better Life. Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Every grain of sand in every desert land, He knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, He knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, He knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, He knows. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering the doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah هو إذا الرحمن
Allah
هو إذا المنان
لا إله إلا.
Please send us your emails to our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have a very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom and Islamic scholar, Sayyid Zain. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid Zain. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Okay, Sayyid Zain, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the book Nahjul Balagha, a book that was compiled by Sayyid Ar-Ravi, one of the most outstanding, blatterist Shiite scholars, Fuqaha and Muhaddisin of the Shiite world. He, along with Sayyid al-Murtadha, were considered among the most outstanding students of Shaykh al-Mufid, and this is why their works found authenticity. But his work, Nahjul Balagha, which is wrongly believed to be the book of Imam Ali alayhi salam, which is not, you know, in the public opinion, sometimes says, did you read, for example, Nahjul Balagha of Imam Ali? This is not the book compiled by Imam Ali himself. Sayyid al-Razi compiled it, and the question is that, is this the first compilation of the words and the sayings, letters, sermons, and the aphorisms of Imam Ali alayhi salam compiled? Whether at his time Imam Ali alayhi salam himself tried to compile something, or his closest companions, in regard to time and the manner, or not?
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. So as you said, Nahjul Balagha, it's a book of compilation of Imam Ali's sayings, his sermons, letters.
Yes.
It's a very important book as well for the Shias and the Muslim world in general. There's a lot of, you know, even Ahl al-Sunnah, Sunni people who have, scholars who have written commentaries on Nahjul Balagha itself and given it importance.
Yes.
Now back to your question, whether it's the first book written about Imam Ali and his sayings. No, so it's not. I'm not aware of what book was the first book,
yes,
whether during Imam Ali himself, his time, something was compiled or not. But we know that there have been many, many books throughout the lives of the Imams,
yes,
that were compiled by the different companions of the Imams. Right, so much so that basically you're told that there were around 6,000 books of a hadith that were compiled.
Yes.
Now, there weren't only, you know, Amirul Mu'minin Imam Ali's sayings. There were, you know, all the different imams. But, you know, traditions were compiled before,
yes,
this time as well.
Mm-hmm.
And amongst those 6,000, there's 400 which are called Usul al-Arba'a'mi'a. Right.
Yes.
So there are the 400 Usul, which are called,
yes,
and there were, you know, 400 books of ahadith from the Imma that were, you know, very famous. And scholars later on, such as Sheikh Kunaini, who compiled, you know, the big volumes of ahadith,
yes,
they used ahadith from these books that were there. And even now, some of these books still exist and have survived as well. Now, within these books, there were certain books that were specifically, you know, the sayings of Amirul Mu'mineen,
yes,
Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Mm-hmm.
And remember that these were compiled during the life of the different Imma.
Yes, that's right. And we know that Sayyid al-Razi compiled this book in the 4th century Hijra. And of course, there have been so many researchers done regarding the madarik and masanet, the asnad and madarik of these. I mean, what were the references, the resources, and the documents to which Sayyidah Razi referred in order to compile Nahjul Balagha. But the eloquence, the fasaha, and the balagha of these words are incomparable to any other type of wording, up to an extent that they call it Akhul Qur'an, the brother of the Holy Qur'an. And not only the Shiites, but so many scholars from our Sunni brethren has approved and confirmed that these wordings cannot be the sayings of a scholar. Right. They are, for example, the words of, we can say, an imam, or it's better to say they are the words of a person whose wording is very much different from the simple or frequent letterists.
Right.
Now the question is that how we can find more authenticity in Nahjul Balagha. I mean, if we want to refer to Nahjul Balagha and find authenticity in that, how we can do that? What should be the styles of the Shiites doing, whether they are a scholar or public people?
So the thing to know regarding Nahjul Balagha is that Sayyid Radi, he did not bring the asnad, he did not bring the chain of narrators. Yes. for the different things that he compiled, different ahadith that he compiled. So now some people, what they do is they raise this objection and they say that, you know, it doesn't have a sanad, it doesn't have, and therefore we cannot accept it, right? We cannot accept anything that comes from it. And I think that's a very skewed way of looking at ahadith and understanding ahadith. Because although it's a question of usul and the scholars, you know, they discuss it, but generally, you know, there's many scholars who would say that the sanad is not the only thing which shows whether a hadith is valid or not. Right, it is one of the indicators, but what's important is that a scholar or somebody looking at the hadith, they should get this surety within themselves that this is from the imam, and no matter which way they get that surety from, that surety itself is valid.
Yes.
Right. So now, as you mentioned, that the eloquence of the words of the imam, so the balagha, the Arabic language itself that is used, that points to the fact that this cannot be from other than the imam.
Mm-hmm.
Or, for example, the ideas that the imam mentions,
yes,
right? The ideas about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and, you know, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and all these ideas that the imam presents, because of the lofty nature of these ideas,
yes,
it points us to this, that, you know, it must be from the imam.
Yes.
IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Praises to Allah, all glories to Allah, we worship Allah and no one but Allah.
For example, Ibn Abil Hadith, our Sunni brother and scholar of the 7th and 8th century Hijra, answers the people who say and compare Nahjul Balagha, for example, to the words of Ibn Nabata or something like that. These were the outstanding letterist or literary man of the literature of the Arab world, said that no wording and no sentence are comparable between the two, and say that Ravi tried to select the most authentic ones, you know.
Right.
And some of the documents in Nahjul Balagha are historical ones. They are proof. For example, the letter that Imam Ali alayhi salam wrote to Malik al-Ashtar.
Right.
Even nowadays, so many people, so many of the statesmen refer to that in order to be guided into the right path of leading a community or Muslim ummah.
So there are different hadiths, that are in Nahjul Balagha that are approved that way as well.
Yes.
And there are scholars who worked on this too, that they have gone and looked at the sources of hadith.
Yes.
And they have found the asnad, the chain of narrations for the different things that are there in Nahjul Balagha.
That's right.
So there's, you know, a few scholars who have worked on this, and that itself gives, you know, gets rid of this doubt to a large extent, that, you know, when people say that Nahjul Balagha doesn't have any authenticity.
Mm-hmm. That's all right.
And also, I think one thing to notice is this, that Sayyid Radi is not somebody who is, you know, just a layman. He's not somebody who is, he's himself a pious, you know, one of the very pious scholars of, you know, the early scholars of Shia Islam as well. Yes. Somebody who was deeply knowledgeable, somebody who was deeply, you know, aware of the hadith and the religion itself. And he himself is trustworthy, right? So now if he brings a book and he says that these narrations are those that I am, you know, approving, in the sense that I'm not even bringing the sanad for it.
Okay.
I'm giving this to you.
Yes.
Then that gives credibility to the whole book itself.
Okay. That's all right. Let's talk a little bit about the content of Nahjul Balagha. What does it consist of?
So Nahjul Balagha has three parts.
Okay.
The first part would be the sermons of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Second part are the letters. And the third are the short sayings of the Imam. Right. And in terms of, you know, the topics that are mentioned there, most of them, from my understanding, would be dealing with things that are, you know, to do with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, aqidah, aqaid, or regarding things that were happening in history at that time, okay. Right? So especially, you know, his letters to the different individuals. And then some of the things, you know, discuss general things in Islam, ahkam in Islam as well. Some of them are advice for us, especially in the short sayings, that we can look at and take, you know, advice for our own selves. And if you're close to the Nahjul Balagha, then that helps us become better people as well through the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
That's right. And some of the khutbahs that you said, you know, become very much famous. For example, khutbah Shakhshaghiyya, number 3, khutbah Qarra, Ashbah, and Ghasa'ah. These were, we can say, among the most. And Khutbah Muttaqeen and Khutbah Qarra, especially Qarra one, from the literary point of view, is really outstanding and precious. And Khutbah Muttaqeen. Also, among the letters, you know, the letters that Imam Ali alayhi salam has sent them to different people, there are historical documents talking about how Imam Ali looked at the world, looked at the concept of Tawheed, Ma'ad, okay, and different things. So if a person who wants to be more familiar with Imam Ali alayhi salam and his character has to refer to Nahjul Balagha.
Yes.
Something, unfortunately, majority of the Muslims may be unaware of. I myself talked to so many people, especially our Sunni brethren. They have never heard of the book Nahjul Balagha, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's full of wisdom, full of, you know, knowledge. For us to benefit from, and you know, it's upon us to really go into it and look at it, and use it to better our own selves.
Yes.
And one of the ideas in you know, which I think kind of jumps out from the Nahjul Balagha itself, which I think is important, and perhaps, you know, I'll mention it as well.
Yes.
Is Imam Ali alayhi salam and his relationship with this world.
Yes.
Right. And how much he is disconnected from this dunya, and how much it's a lesson for us, right?
Yes.
And if you, and especially, you know, during his time when he was officially the Khalifa,
yes.
You know, obviously he was the Imam, but then he was officially made the Khalifa as well, and he's the head of this government and, you know, this empire by this time, the Islamic Empire.
Yes.
And you see how simply he lives. You see how you know, away from the things of this dunya, the glamour, the, you know, being famous, and it's really amazing. It's really a lesson for us.
Yes.
And especially if you look at Imam Ali alayhi salam, Amir al-Mu'mineen, and we look at some of the rulers that are there in, unfortunately, in the world, and even in the Islamic world, right? And we compare that, and we see that there is, you know, very little resemblance to Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, unfortunately.
That's right. Those people who are interested, we can say, knowing more about Nahjul Balagha also can refer to another work by contemporary scholar Nahjus Sa'ada, Fi Mustadak Nahjul Balagha, we can say compiled by, you know, Allama Mahmoudi. This book also is also very much important. In that book also, Muhammad Baqir al-Mahmoudi, compiled this book. In that book, some of the references and resources are explained in details, and this shows the authenticity of the work of Sayyid al-Radi. Still, so many people are concerned with writing exegesis on natural balagha, or for example shar, or they translated into different languages all around the world because the people think that it is useful for them. Also, when you refer to, for example, the Christian blatterist George Jordagh, who wrote the book Al-Imam Ali As-Sawt al-Adalat al-Insaniya, he says that maybe more than 200 times I've read Nahjul Balagha, and still I'm reading it and find so many new things. Is that okay? So we can say shows that the Shias have heavy responsibility regarding Nahjul Balagha to read it every day.
It also shows the connection that the Ahlul Bayt have with the Quran, right? Because the Quran is the same thing.
Yes.
For more than 1,000 years, people have been reading it a lot. Right? Shaykh Ramadan is coming, inshallah.
Yes, inshallah.
And we'll be reading the Quran again. And Muslims have been reading Quran, doing tafsir of the Quran, understanding the Quran, and still it's fresh, still it's new. And it shows you that it's from a source that is a divine source. And same is the words of the Ahlul Bayt as well, because as we say, they're Quran natiq, right? They are the speaking Quran. That they have different levels as well of understanding. They have, the more you go into it, you keep going into it and keep understanding deeper and deeper and deeper.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sayyid Zain, for a nice elaboration regarding the authenticity of Nahjul Balagha, compiled by Sayyid al-Razi, regarding the words and the statements of Imam Ali alayhi salam. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min labani aliyin wa husayin wa hasan. لعلي وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن.
Aperture.
Back to Aperture, everyone. In the first part of the documentary, we met the hidden victims of America's multi-billion dollar chemical industry. By offering an excellent wage and a comfortable retirement package, chemical giants Dow Chemical and DuPont factories are welcome wherever they go. For many of the town's residents, a job at Dow Chemical or DuPont marks the beginning of a very glimmering future. Yet, victims like Alice, Kenton, and Rukna have seen the ugly truth behind this prosperity. Don't go away. Here's the rest of our program.
850 children are now registered at Rashida B's Center. In 2015, Dow gave $4.5 billion to its shareholders. But not a single cent has been given to the decontamination of Bhopal. For weeks, we tried to reach the communications department at Dow to get an interview, without success.
The water that people drink. Who's going to answer those questions? It's really important.
I'm not aware of who that is right off the top of my head. We have 50,000 employees, so I'll have to do some research.
Dow never called us back. So we decided to go to the company's General Assembly in Midland, in the U.S., to ask our questions. A few days later, we finally received an email from Dow. The company laments, "Bhopal was a terrible tragedy that we will never forget." But they relieved themselves of all responsibility, stating that, "We acquired Union Carbide more than 16 years after the catastrophe of 1984.
Dow continues to address global issues through human solutions. Issues like clean water, as important as life itself. Dow is working to make water safe and readily available to people all over the globe. The human element. Nothing is more fundamental. Nothing more elemental."
In Dow's wake, countless victims and human tragedies pile up without any damage to the company's profits. In December 2015, Dow announced the biggest financial operation in its history. A merger of $130 billion with another American chemical giant, DuPont. A match made in heaven.
You and DuPont, there's a lot of good chemistry between us.
DuPont made its fortune with dynamite.
Dynamite!
Nylon. And Teflon. The magical material that prevents food from sticking to pans. However, behind the success of Teflon, DuPont hides a dark secret.
I just can't believe at DuPont the money means more than people.
There's people dying because of what they've done.
DuPont knew years ago what they were doing.
At best, it's despicable. At the worst, it's criminal.
At the heart of this drama is one city. Parkersburg, lost in the eastern U.S. The city was built around the DuPont factory. Suzanne Bailey came here in 1978 to work on the Teflon production lines.
I went to work in May the 8th, 1978. That was my glorious day. That was the elite job. I mean, everybody wanted to go there because for the money, for the benefits, and everything like that. It was secure.
The chemical industry is a growing one, growing by leaps and bounds.
I mean, you could just mention the DuPont name and doors swung open. It was like princes coming through the door, you know?
Yes, in such an environment, you can look to a bright future with confidence and optimism.
Were you happy, sir?
I was thrilled. I was absolutely thrilled to death.
A few months after starting her job at DuPont, Suzanne Bailey became pregnant. In January of 1981, she gives birth to little Bucky.
When he was born, it was very traumatic. They didn't know what to do with him. They'd never seen anything like it. I could not figure out what happened. He had half a nostril, half a nose. The eye is a keyhole pupil. I didn't know what to do. I was afraid he was going to die in my arms. I had no idea what was wrong.
Bucky survived. He is now 35 years old. But his childhood was spent between his home and the hospital.
I had 30 surgeries in a span of, you know, 6 to 7 years, where they took rib cartilage to form my nose. I have a metal plate here. They stretched my forehead out so that they could use that skin and bring it down and mold my nose here. I still only have one nostril, functioning nostril.
We had to put the hockey mask on him and the guards because he wasn't allowed to touch his face.
For how long?
He had to wear those for, I would say, 3 months, 4 months.
It's a long time.
Yeah, the only way that he got to take them off was just to eat.
How is it as a kid to grow up and to have, you know, so many surgeries? And I mean, it's pretty intense, you know.
Walking out in public and going into a store or a restaurant, and as soon as you enter, all the eyes are on you. And school, when you go in and you're trying to make new friends, all they see is you're different.
After her maternity leave, Suzanne Bailey began to suspect her job as the cause of Bucky's deformities. A mysterious source tips her off to one molecule in particular, C8, the molecule in Teflon that stops food from sticking to pans.
When I went back to work the first day, I went to the locker and I found the paper laying there. I picked it up and I began reading about it. It was talking about how the rats were fed the C8 and what deformities that it had around their face. And I thought, that sounds just like Bucky.
It was very similar to what Bucky had.
Absolutely. Very similar, almost identical to what he had. That's why I knew that there was something wrong. That's why I connect.
The scientific study Suzanne Bailey found had been conducted by a subcontractor of DuPont. It studied baby rats whose mothers were exposed to C8. They developed abnormal eye lenses.
I immediately walked out that door, went down to medical, and I said, is this what's wrong with my baby? Oh, no, no, no. Nothing on this planet will hurt you. That was the motto. That's what they always say.
Yeah.
Nothing here will hurt you.
But in the meantime, DuPont was secretly investigating the pregnant women working in their factory. 2 out of 7 children born to the factory workers had facial deformities like Bucky. Shortly after, DuPont decided to transfer Suzanne Bailey and her colleagues to other departments. At the time, Kenton Wamsley also worked in the manufacturing department of Teflon. He remembers the discussion he had with his manager.
He said, Ken, we sent all the women home out of Teflon. All of them. He said, oh, don't worry. It won't hurt the men. Just the women. We feel that it can cause trouble. So I thought, won't hurt me.
Kenton Wamsley was a lab technician. He handled C8 for 30 years.
Breathe the fumes from them, all the samples we breathe. But we just, you know, at the time we thought DuPont would take care of us. And so I just did my jobs for years and years, you know. And we didn't realize that our health was an issue then. Surgeon diagnosed me as having cancer. He had to take all my rectum, part of my colon.
Now Kenton Wamsley has to live with an ostotomy bag attached to his stomach. He changes it day and night. At the factory, he worked in a team with 3 other technicians.
My buddies, people I really love, seen them every day, cared about them. Those guys are all dead, and I should have been. They didn't even see retirement, none of them.
Wamsley and his colleagues were never warned about the risks of C8. However, we procured a confidential document from DuPont. It's dated 1982, 34 years ago. In it, Mr. Rector at the time expresses concern about the consequences of C8 retained in the blood of employees. He specifically recommends that practical steps be taken to reduce this exposure.
All employees, not just Teflon area workers, are exposed. So rather than to do anything, they just wrote it out. I never seen a letter like that. I'm mad. You can see why. We could have prevented a lot of lives if they would have told us there's a problem. Why'd they cover it up? Why'd they lie? Why didn't they have us protected? Too costly?
We tracked down Bruce Carr, DuPont's former medical director. He is now enjoying a peaceful retirement by the ocean, far from Parkersburg.
I have a document of 1982 showing that you were aware that C8 was toxic for workers. Why have you not told them the truth at that time?
They were all told the truth. They were told everything we knew at the time.
Actually, no. I have interviewed some employees and they were not aware of anything.
We told employees everything we knew as soon as we knew it. If you go back to 1982, you're trying to do reconstructions. History. And you can't do that.
Why have you not protected your employees?
Il a raccroché.
DuPont would not only put their employees in danger. Once again, tens of thousands of people would be affected. They live up to 70 kilometers away from the factory. One man would discover this, a bit by accident. Joe Kiger. On October 31st, 2000, he receives a letter from the municipality concerning the quality of the tap water. It mentions C8.
I was sitting in my courtyard, and the wife was watering the flowers, and we got our water bill in the mail, and with that bill came a letter. It's like you get form letters all the time. So you look at it and say, oh, okay, bang, and you put it over, and you don't think about it. Next thing you know, you throw it away. And that's basically what this was. It just caught my attention, and I started reading through it, and then the flag started popping up. First of all, what was C8 here, mm-hmm. which is used by DuPont Works? Well, what's DuPont have to do with our water?
Joe Kiger sought clarification on the matter.
I called DuPont to try to find out. So they put me in touch with a guy, a gentleman named Mr. Kennedy, and I said, you know, I'd like to know more about this C8 issue. He just told me it's nothing to worry about. About it was just a byproduct of Teflon, and it wasn't anything to worry about. And he was flat-out lying to me, I could tell that.
To get to the bottom of it, he takes DuPont to court. After a long legal battle, the judge forces the company to declassify their internal studies on C8. Joe Kiger discovers the truth behind the factory at Parkersburg. For decades, they've been dumping C8 waste into the river. To make things worse, DuPont has known since 1984 that the molecule spread into the region's tap water. The company found astronomical levels in public taps, up to 50 times the limit of toxicity, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
That was 1984, and we didn't come out till 2000.
So with 16 years.
Yeah, before we even hit them up about it. And they chose, as you see right here, they chose not to do anything about it. And they knew what was coming with the liabilities if they got caught. They were trying to slide under the radar. People trusted DuPont for so long. They have done nothing but lie for years to people about what this stuff's all about. There's sick people out here because of what they've done. There's people dying because of what they've done.
During all these years, more than 70,000 people have been drinking contaminated water. In 2011, both scientific research and the U.S. justice system established that C8 could cause six diseases: thyroid disorder, high cholesterol, ulcerative colitis, high blood pressure, kidney cancer, or testicular cancer. Today, 3,500 people in the Parkersburg region are ill. They've all filed complaints against DuPont. This is the case for Earl and Gwen Botkin.
I've had ulcerative colitis for about 17 years, and it's about killed me a couple times. I still have thyroid problem, and I have high cholesterol. And those are all associated with C8.
Today, Earl Botkin doesn't have a colon anymore. He, too, is living with an ostomy bag.
So all of a sudden, you don't function normally, but you have your bowel movement on your side. And that's what I live with until I die. And there's not any hope of that's going to change. It controls where I go, what I do, and what I eat. And just controls a lot of things in my life. But anyway, I lived through that.
A document reveals that all of these victims could have been spared. On May 22, 1984, a meeting took place at the DuPont headquarters. The directors are worried about the consequences for the inhabitants. They plan to eliminate all C8 emissions. But finally, no measures are taken. Their argument, it's not economically attractive.
That was in what year?
84. That's before we were married. That's a long time ago. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Long, long time ago.
That's crazy. That's what makes it so bad, you know, that they had evidence all along and just disregarded it and kept doing what they were doing.
It was company greed that caused this whole situation. They knew what they were doing to us, and they continued to do it for money. That's the only reason they continued to do it.
DuPont refuses to collectively compensate the 3,500 sick people. They prefer to study the cases one by one. As a result, since 2012, only one victim has been able to get a trial. DuPont was sentenced to pay her $1.6 million. The 3,499 remaining victims, like Earl Botkin, are still waiting. At the current pace of the trials, the last one would take place in 100 years.
Do you still trust and you're still confident that you will get a trial at some point?
Oh. It
lives long enough.
If I live to be 150, I'm right. It's kind of, there will be a trial someday. But the chances of me living long enough to ever see that are probably slim to none. But we're just another document, another number of cases to be tried. DuPont has made billions of dollars. I think they should stand up to what they've done and make it right with the people they've made sick.
DuPont refused all of our requests for an interview, so we drove to their headquarters in Delaware on the East Coast to convince them to answer our questions. At the other end of the line, we reached the head of media relations, Daniel Turner.
We are doing a documentary piece. The best way is, you know, we meet and to make a proper interview, you know, at some point. But first, let's meet. You know, I'm just here.
We'll respectfully decline the on-camera interview. I will provide you with a statement.
You know, there is like an incredible amount of documents showing that you have known at DuPont for the past 30 years that C8 was toxic. And you know that you were poisoning your employees at the Washington Works plant and the Parkersburg citizen. Why are you not recognizing the fact that you have deliberately poisoned thousands of persons?
Okay, so are those the questions you're asking?
Yeah, this is my questions.
Okay, I'll be happy to provide with our statement.
Today we are in 2016. There are still 3,500 persons with severe disease that are waiting to just have the right to get a trial. I mean, for how long are you going to deny your responsibility? Are you waiting that they all die?
So, we will provide you with a statement for your piece.
Nothing else? No?
Like I said, we will provide you with a statement. Thanks so much. Have a good day. Bye.
Bye.
We did receive a press release from DuPont, but without a single word for the victims. They claim to have studied C8 carefully for decades and affirm to have always acted responsibly. In 2015, DuPont finally stopped using C8. The company was also ordered by the courts to clean up the region. But how many generations are still to experience the after effects of this contamination? In the chemical world, history inexorably tends to repeat itself. It takes decades to reveal the truth, and just as many years for the multinationals to be prosecuted. In their laboratories, new toxic molecules are constantly being developed. But in 10, 20, 30, or 40 years, Who knows how many new victims will be poisoned?
Merged together, Dow Chemical and DuPont create the world's largest chemical company in terms of sales. Yet, the victims' testimonies, those whose lives have been poisoned, will forever cast a shadow over this industry as they fight in the hope that someday their culprits will be brought to justice. And that's it for this week, everyone. Join us next time for another documentary. It's goodbye.
اون چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله إلا الله الله يا الله والله أكبر.
Imam Khomeini's historic speech outlining the state of affairs of the course of the revolution. Date January 23, 1983. Topic: Importance of Propagating Islamic Culture. Brothers and sisters of the various faiths should join hands, defend the reputation and aims of Islam and the Islamic Republic, and not be afraid of this clamor, for we shall not be defeated. You who are shouldering a heavy responsibility, continue with confidence and solidarity with your job. Expand and improve your programs every day and make efforts to present programs that are original and conform to the teachings of Islam and safeguard your nation and your religion.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And the subject of victory and its factors. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh said, "A divine purpose leads to victory." Well, this is one of the most elegant and important statements of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh about victory. You know, faith is the unique element which can give such strength to human spirit and so expand the area of its activity as to prepare it to face the hardest and most complex of problems without giving in or cowering. The person imbued with faith knows that hardships, no matter how severe, will not stand in front of his undefeatable spirit and will be overcome. The strength to bear hardship and adversity saves man from certain psychic illnesses. It is the power of faith which definitely increases a person's capacity for forbearance without affecting his mental equilibrium and his steadiness on the path of his goal.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi.
Sallallahu alayhi.
The Prophet of Islam sallallahu alaihi wasallam considers this merit as one of the characteristics of godly men, and he says, "The man of faith is like gold bullion. If placed in the furnace, it grows red hot, and when it is weighed afterwards, its weight is not diminished in the least. Imam Ali alayhi salam also said, in that regard, the spirit of a person possessing faith is more resistant than the hardest stone. You know, these two hadiths show the significance of faith and divine purposes in forming the moral strength of a Muslim. And we see that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh saw the aim, which is something divine, as the main motivation for a faithful Muslim, and depicted victory for such a view as it was exactly the case in Iran's great revolution, when people resisted against the faithless for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and finally they reached the sweet fruit of victory and success. Thank you very much for being with us in this episode of Spring of the Truth. I hope that you have enjoyed it, and until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Germany's industrial output extended its slump to a seventh month in December, underlining the struggles gripping Europe's largest economy. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Bloomberg Television has covered this story and tells us more. Germany's economic woes keep mounting as early surveys show gloom for 2024 and a bumpy road ahead. According to the American-based news network, investors lending money to German companies are now demanding higher interest rates than companies in the rest of the Eurozone. This is due to several factors, including the struggling German economy, real estate troubles, and Germany's reputation for having the highest corporate distress ranking in Europe. This predicament came about due to surging energy prices, which began after Germany joined the West's anti-Russian sanctions. Consequently, the country had to cut off its supply of cheap Russian gas to its energy-dependent manufacturing sector. Brian Mangwiro, a fund manager at Barings, told Bloomberg Television, "Germany is really in trouble. All the big manufacturing economies are slowing down, but in Germany, this is compounded by higher energy costs. There are also challenges in the auto sector, with competition coming from China. There has been a marked decline in borrowing by businesses to invest in factories, machinery, and technology. This shows that Germany's economic growth is impeded in the long term, while companies are currently more focused on tackling their problems. The bigwigs at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland last January were feeling quite despondent. It was evident that Europe's largest economy was experiencing instability and grappling with fierce competition.